Hello, and welcome to the Mentor Dino podcast. I'm your host, Caitlin Rossier. I am an architect and founder of Mentor Dino. Join me each week as I speak with amazing professionals in and around the architecture, engineering, and construction industry, as we are all part of a larger interconnected community. We discuss everything from career stories, lessons learned, and advice for others finding their own unique career path. Thank you to all of our current subscribers, and if you're new, welcome to the conversation. And if you like this episode, please do me a favor by hitting subscribe, like, or share it with a friend. It really helps others be able to discover this resource and support them on their own unique career journey. On today's episode of the Mentor Dino podcast, I would like to welcome Gabriella Bermia, Senior Associate at Perkins Eastman down in Austin, Texas. Thank you, Gabriella, for taking the time to speak with me today.
Thanks for having me, Caitlin. I'm so excited to be here.
So I always like starting out with my loaded question, if you don't mind introducing yourself to my listeners so they know a little bit about your experience and journey so far in your education and career.
For sure. Hey, y'all. My name is Gabriella, or Gabby Bermea. I'm a licensed architect and senior associate at a firm called Perkins Eastman, where I get to work on K-12 facilities all over the world, which is truly a dream of mine. I've been working in the AC industry since 2016, so this is year 10 for me, which is a major milestone that I'll talk about with the Architect Big Sis platform, where, you know, by day I get to design schools, and outside of that, I've really gotten to connect with this social media audience all over the world, where I've kind of noted this Architect Big Sis persona, where I get to mentor students and early career professionals through the power of social media, essentially reaching, you know, millions around the world, which is awesome. My mom is actually an educator, so education has always been central to my life when it comes to how I plug in with my community. And it turns out that designing spaces where learning happens is exactly where I was supposed to be as a practitioner. So it's great to see that come full circle at this point in time, and I'm excited to see where the future goes.
Yeah. So what was your career leading up to Perkins Eastman? Have you always been at Perkins Eastman?
Yeah, so I have actually always been in K through 12. So I started at a firm in 2016, my third year in architecture school. It's really a funny story. I was actually going to work for the Planning Commission here in Austin, and that job fell through, and I was not able to have it. And this was right before my third year final review, and I was freaking out because I was like, I'm supposed to come back to Austin. I'm supposed to have a job. Well, let me look on Google and start finding out what other things are available out there. And sure enough, I saw an ad for an intern at Stantec. And I actually thought, well, oh my gosh, Stantec is an engineering firm. I don't even know if it's an architecture position. So I gave them a call and, you know, followed up with my resume and website. And I got a phone call like 3 hours later from Scott, who then ended up like being a part of my career almost this entire time. And he said, hey, we'd love to interview you. Can you be available virtually the next day? And I said, sure. Now, me not having like an actual portfolio, I had a website, remember, but I did not have a design portfolio available, which was stressing me out because I was like, okay, do I stay up all night and just create a design portfolio or just go with what I've got and prepare the words that I'm going to speak to? And sure enough, I went with the second route, right? I started with just going ahead and saying, you know, here's my website. No, I don't have a full design portfolio, but I can walk you through kind of these web things that I've created. And that actually ended up being a major differentiator along with, you know, the conversational skills and talking about my work. I never got to actually work in the architecture building. I actually worked with the UREC. Shout out to the University of Recreation at University of Arkansas. I was a student manager there and kind of like pivoted to, hey, I'm used to working on large collaborative teams. I oversee a team of 25 to 35 for 4 hours a day for, you know, 3 to 4 days a week. Getting to use those tangible skills that you would think have nothing to do with architecture, but have everything to do with time management and working on a team helped me kind of see the full picture. And thankfully, it ended up being really great chemistry. I joined there in 2016 and worked there for 4 years up until the pandemic, to where I had a really great opportunity at another firm. One of my principals had moved to another firm in Austin that was a Texas-based architecture firm called BLK. And I, you know, had a lovely time there. I was there for 4 years as well. There was where I got my license, where I got to see my first school opening. Like, it was a major career moment getting to work there. And then in 2024, I had the opportunity, I had gotten an outreach from Perkins Eastman, and it was kind of the easiest yes as far as the point in time in my career where I had this, you know, very obvious, it felt like a pivotal moment in where I was mentally, right? You're kind of in this space where, hey, I know it's time to grow and it's time to see something new in the profession. And I was really excited to get the chance to work beyond my local community, which I loved, but I had only had worked in Texas for my first 8 years of my career, which was amazing. Then when I, you know, joined on to PE, had my first coffee with Patrick Davis, who's one of our principals here in Austin. And it was an immediate, like, we understand, we're speaking the same language as far as our passion for education, for design, for planning, and for just making, using architecture to make people's lives better, which is at the end of the day, what my entire goal and my hope is for the profession. So, you know, you fast forward to, well, actually, I fast forward like 3 weeks, my first 3 weeks into Perkins Eastman, I'm on a flight and I'm in Colorado. We're working on this amazing project with the 11 public schools in Colorado Springs. And it's a community meeting. We're engaged with a lot of people. And one of the leadership there, who now is a good friend of mine, came over and said, you know, how many years have you guys been working together? And it was the best feeling in the world because we kind of looked at her and smiled and we're like, it's been 2 weeks. And it was just, you know, when you get into a firm and you realize, wow, this is where I was supposed to be. That is very much the feeling that has came here. And that goes not only to the K-12 team, but, you know, our Austin studio, our Texas studios have that same humility, but also in the same vein, we are looking to make the built environment a better place and learn the business alongside of that. So that's been where my career has kind of matured to now. And I'm so excited about it.
Yeah. And the best part of that story is really how you really take hold of what position you're going for and how much you loved and enjoyed it. So every time you started out with a firm, it is based on where you are in your career, right, what you're looking for, what your needs are. And that's what needs to light the fire for you. And it doesn't mean the fire can't burn out. You know, you don't have to have that fire. Sometimes you outgrow a position or need a different change of pace. And I love the sequence of almost 4-year increments.
I know.
And so
I hate it. I'm ready to break that. That's been my goal. I'm breaking the 4 years. But, you know, it was like you're saying, Caitlin, it was just the time and the place. And when you realize, hey, I've grown to another pace in my career. And this is a conversation for firms to have, especially now being on the firm leadership side, is if you notice that happening within certain, you know, career stages for architects, for young professionals, for early career professionals, I'll say that for those who have came back into practice, that is a pivotal point in people's maturity where they feel like, hey, I have enough of the understanding of the practice. I know where this is going. I know where the ship is steering, but I personally need some additional growth opportunities out beyond just where my focus is now. And, you know, we work in project schedules that are a year, 2 years of construction, mm-hmm. 3 years of construction. If you're talking about a high school, to see that kind of relate to an architecture career and then not get missed as new folks come in, as the firm continues to shift. That's a very, very important part that I think as a practice, we need to continue to consider, especially if we want, you know, there's 20, 30 year professionals who want to stay at a firm for the long run and really understand the motivations behind it.
Yeah. And some people leave firms because they love it there, or not because they love it there, but they could love it. But the growth ceiling exists. A firm can only have so many principals on staff, depends on their project load. And say you want to jump up to a principal level, and that's just not in the cards at that firm in the next 10 years.
Yeah.
That may not be good enough for an individual, and that may be a sign for them to leave. So it's not always somebody gets burned out or unhappy. It's just where your growth is, and you have to follow your growth.
Exactly. And then I think really understanding the motivations behind, well, what is it about principal that I best identify with, right? And maybe it's, hey, I know I'm not ready for this role yet, but what things do I need to do to start moving this way? And, you know, I had a boss once who said something to the effect of, if I have to give you a roadmap, then you shouldn't be in that role. I think that's a completely outdated way of thinking of the practice, especially when, you know, now more than ever, you have AI coming into our practice, and you've got these new learning models that have been, you know, completely adapting the way that we talk, the way that we speak, and the way that we open up entry-level roles, right? So if there are less and less at that mm-hmm. point, we're going to be, you know, where we are now, where we have an entire missing middle of 2008 recession architects who went another direction, which is amazing because they found careers, because an architecture degree is incredibly valuable when it comes to transferable skills. But we want you back in practice, right? That should be the end goal, and making it somewhere where, hey, if someone asks the question, how did you get to your path, or what are things that can be improved in what we're doing today, and come with genuine ideas, it shouldn't be something that someone gets shunned away for.
Yeah. And it's opportunities to help reduce the burden of senior staff.
Very much so.
So if your principals or project managers are getting burned out, who are the people that are itching for those positions that they could work under that senior professional and get trained up? So you're not taking a big leap in having to learn. It's, hey, you're helping some current stress that, you know, you have fee for, you can build up your professional, and they can get that experience and practice and build up to that promotion.
Yeah, absolutely.
Being able to do the work. And but you gotta listen, and you gotta see what people are doing.
Think about that foresight. Yeah, absolutely. And people are, you know, it's funny because you get to the end of your career and like you're getting toward retirement, and then thinking about succession planning. If you've gotten to that point, you're mm-hmm. behind the eight ball. You really need to be identifying who are the next people to take those steps for you, whether that is, you know, firm ownership, market leadership, principals. You need to identify them 5 to 8 years before they're even ready for that role, more than anything else, because there are some maturity points that they need to hit within their career. Not only that, but some legitimacy as well. You cannot expect for someone else to step into that role but not have, you know, the years of primed up experience, right? Or you hire someone from another firm and then you risk the possibility of a mismatch of cultures, right? So being able to have these conversations, I think, are much more beneficial than just early career professionals. But this has to happen to our seasoned professionals as well. They are having this foresight to really know, hey, what's coming next? Who are we thinking wants to even step into these roles, and having a transparent conversation.
Yeah, because you need to let them know that those discussions are happening to see, A, if you understood their goals, that's something they want to look forward to, or that they know that, you know, they care about your career. If you keep everything in a leadership bubble and you don't disseminate down on goals and strategies and career growth, the professional's not going to see that, and they may still leave.
Right. So. And what's wild to me is we always think of it like, oh, well, it's the firms that have too little spots, and the professionals are finding everywhere. Like, they cannot get into the firm, as opposed to the architecture practice has to stay innovative enough to make people want to stay here, because there are so many other opportunities. There are jobs we don't even know exist yet that could be greatly applicable to licensed architects or people who have an architecture education but do not practice architecture traditionally. We need to compete as a profession to make sure that we keep the best of the best within our role as well. So, you know, you're right, Kaylin, having those conversations about goal setting and orientation on communication is absolutely critical to making sure this is a profession people want to be a part of.
Yeah. And I want to step back a little bit further. Sorry. And no, we're good. Let's jump back into college and your actual career path stepping into architecture, because I know you talk a lot about the struggles in architecture school and adjusting to your first year in practice. Can you explain that story a little bit, just so everybody kind of catches up on those struggles, because they're not just you?
Yeah, for sure. You know, the more I talk about these things, the more I realize, hey, more than one person was having this exact same struggle. The first year of architecture was humbling, to say the least. Architecture has a school of, it's got this thing of making it seem like everyone else has an instructional manual and you are the only person who missed out on the memo. Like, for me, it felt like, you know, there weren't a lot of other people who looked like me or sounded like me who were in studio. I mean, I found my best friends there. I found my future husband there, which was amazing. But in the same vein, I felt like a fish out of water, like I didn't belong. Like, there weren't any other border kids. There were hardly any other Latinos who were in the class. So when you try to find something that you know, culturally resonated with, it felt a little lonely. And then, you know, you add the isolating fact that you are constantly working till midnight, so you're sleep deprived. Everyone is cranky. No one is eating. It's just a really toxic environment that first, first 4 months. And I attribute a lot to the culture and the pressure that we put on each other. But I think that has a lot to do with the people who are teaching the studio, right? Who are allowing that culture to happen. And I've seen a great shift. You know, I've gotten the chance to go back to Arkansas multiple times, and there is a major shift in how the students are thinking. And that has everything to do with the professors and leadership that have changed now, which I just can't applaud more, because now we see professionals who are sustainable and, you know, have this joyous personality around architecture rather than letting it be their entire personality. What got me through it is being honest about what I didn't know and not pretending. I actually had to find the people, even one or two, who were just willing to help, whether that was people who were in a studio above me or other classmates, trying not to be the blind leading the blind. But you see who gets picked out as the best every time, and you kind of talk with them and say, hey, what did you think of here? And then having that transparency meant a lot. Although, you know, I had to remind myself multiple times that feeling out of place doesn't mean that you don't belong, especially in architecture school. It took me a while to get to that realization, really, not until I got into the workplace. And then, you know, some of my best professors were those who were actually practicing architects within fourth and fifth year, that said, hey, you have a place here. You just need to keep going. Just keep going. You've got a great career ahead of you. And that was really my motivation to stay. I had been told, I know people get this all the time, like fall of first year, and then right before second year started, it got pulled aside and said, hey, you might want to consider something else. I think your skill sets are for, you know, other things. And to be valid, they were not for what we were doing in Design Studio One. Like, if my job now was just creating, you know, charcoal drawings and doing those, you know, small projects and model building, I probably would not have the career that I have right now, if that's the only thing that architecture looked like. But I needed those foundational skills in order to understand, you know, the management and business development side of things that would come in my career, you know, years later.
Yeah, I feel like the old way of teaching was, well, brute force and seeing how many people can drop out, but really focused on there's only one path in architecture, and you better go want to be a design lead in a capital A architecture firm. And that's actually a very small percentage of architects. And I'm a very technical, practical architect. And so, like, some of those really design studio classes that really made you think out of the box, I struggled with, because I was just like, well, this doesn't even work. Or how would this move around? And then where's the water going to go over here? You got to be able to drain this for, like, these crazy cantilevered open spaces. So it's like, oh, the way I was thinking in school was actually more aligned with how we are in practice than studio. But studio made me feel like I was wrong and that I shouldn't be worried about this stuff. And it wasn't until I had a professor, we did a multi-family apartments, and he would go around to projects and say, fire here, all these people are dead, fire here, all these people are dead. And he taught us egress. And I was like, this is a very brutal way to teach egress, but it started to teach fundamental things, as, you know, code and budget are restrictive. But if you don't practice with that mindset, then you're going to lose the design.
Absolutely.
If you don't learn it, then, you know, all of our designs are just going to be boxes and boring. So I'm glad they're shifting over in Arkansas. So
I
think my program's gone a little bit more of a designy path than I would like them to take. But hey, I'm not a professor, so I'll keep my mouth shut.
No, it's interesting to see. And I think that's, like, one of the valid experiences of being, you know, this, what entirely encompasses the competency of being an architect, right? Yes, those design skills are one of them. But when it comes to the health, safety, and welfare, that's not something you want regulated, right? So, like, in the design sense of things, you know, you talk about health, safety, and security, which should be and are, according to the NAB, NAB accreditation measures, a key part, a critical part of architecture education should be. But you primarily see it in the comprehensive studios, right? That's where I get really excited, because people start to see how buildings come together. But those first few years, And that's really where I felt it, where I felt, oh, gosh, this is really what we're doing. We can actually work in a team. I don't have to be the sole genius. No, my entire, it's like architecture is one big group project and we just never stop. Getting to see that was really beneficial for me, for when I was in school and then even now in the profession.
Yeah, it's definitely a pivot, and it's always fun when you actually see you're on the right path,
right?
No matter what people tell you in the past.
Exactly.
And I know we first met whenever I was running an architecture exam story series with Mentor Dino, and you shared your story. And I remember when I started collecting these stories, I failed two exams, and I thought I was a failure of an aspiring architect whenever I was going for it. And then even trying to hide that I failed two exams whenever I actually became licensed. And when I started collecting stories, I was so impressed with the individuals that were willing to share their story and hit a lot of struggles with the architecture exams and multiple failures, and were willing to share their story and put it in a blog post to help others, to show that you can still pass, you can still be an amazing architect, and nobody's going to ever ask you how many exams you passed or failed unless you have a crazy person like me reach out to you. So I know that you went through, there were seven exams then. Were you on 4.0?
No, I've been 5.0. So I started my exam.
Okay,
in
so you had six.
2018. Total.
Mm-hmm.
Yeah.
And you actually took 16 exams.
I did. Passing six of the 16, the six that needed. So
can you tell your story on getting through those exams and keeping up that motivation and drive that, you know, you can do this, it's okay, and keeping yourself going if anybody else is struggling?
Yeah, of course. And I mean, I think it's really important to contextualize it as well. In that 16 times, that was within the framework of about 2.5 years, from 20 or 3 years, right at 3 years, from November of 2018 until September of 2021. And the reason why I give those dates is because it was so critical to me that I passed those exams. So it was in my head. And if anyone knows me, like once I get something in my head, I get like hyper fixated on it. And then like this goal, we're going to work on it. We're going to push through. And that came with a lot of strife. I mean, and I mentioned the 16 times because I'm not trying to glamorize it or say, hey, you need to spend all this money on these exams. But because the licensure profession, especially when it comes to exams, is genuinely hard. And it's not always evenly distributed, right? There are some systemic barriers. One of the pieces that caused me to shift to another firm in the pandemic era is because I was right in the middle of taking my licensing exams and I needed more technical experience and I was not getting it at that position. And I think it's a really nuanced conversation for architecture candidates to have because you need to take the AXP seriously, especially if you are going to take exams to follow that need to justify what you've learned and do your AXP the way that it's supposed to be done, right? Make sure that you're getting those PDD hours and those PPD hours. And, you know, I had a serious conversation with my hiring manager and said, hey, I need this experience in order to really become a licensed architect, which is my goal. And we just weren't able to get that on the same timeline. So I made my transition over and then a year later was licensed. Back to the barriers, there are resource barriers, there are life circumstances that are not going to pause while you're trying to study. And what kept me going is being honest that, you know, even though like in my head, I was going to be past 6 months after graduation, which I feel like is in everyone's head as soon as they finish, as soon as they graduate college. But, you know, it wasn't going to happen until I had the right support and the right attitude and mindset behind taking my exams, which was really shifting from I'm just reading and absorbing to actual application and practice, which is going to happen over time. Giving up, in all honesty, would have meant that I let a test define my ceiling, and I just wasn't willing to compromise on that, whether that meant 16 or 25. There was just no stopping. And I hope to give the same kind of encouragement to those who are in the middle of that, you know, frustrating ARE exam experience. And to those who passed it all on the first try, congratulations and share your pro tips. That's all I got to say.
Yeah, because there's so many different nuances between, you know, what's actually going on in your home life. When we were both taking the exams, the rolling clock was still there. I can't remember if Texas also got rid of it. But that was a big barrier for many people who started families or would fail a bunch of times, but then had project deadlines they had to meet and just needed to take breaks from studying.
Absolutely.
And then there's also the side of, you know, if you're bilingual, a lot of people struggle with the exams, or if you go down a firm route of residential,
yeah,
it can also be hard because the AREs are a little bit more dense in terms of the commercial side of architecture.
Absolutely.
So depending on the firm you're in, whether you're doing high design and not the technical, or you're not seeing CA, or you're doing one little component of architecture, there are so many barriers that can lead to people struggling through them.
And then you add in, you know, does your firm provide study time for you to use? Does your firm provide study resources, reimbursements of exams? You know, is your, do they provide an opportunity for you to remotely take the exams in your office space? I mean, it goes on and on beyond just the content itself, but into the situational awareness of everything around you. The AREs feel like they're more a test of where you are professionally and personally beyond just, you know, taking, passing an exam and then getting your ARE hours, or sorry, your AXP hours as well.
Yeah. Do you have any tips for somebody that's struggling that maybe needed a little motivational push?
Yeah, absolutely. I think things pivoted for me again when I talked about the application and practical component. I would actually take the books that are put in the exam reference, the ARE 5.0 reference, right? So you see MEEB in there, you see architectural graphic standards, and create your own practice questions off of them, right? Remember, do not share what you saw on the exam with anyone else. I need to go through that, through the rules of conduct, but be sure, you know, if you are working through diagrams, hide things, create your own study cards, create your own, quizzes. And the reason why I say that is because I had to rethink. So I was like in high school, this is part of the other thing on why my high achieving mindset doesn't stop. I was a super high achiever in high school, like 34 on the ACT. Like that was always my goal. And I worked really hard to get there through using, you know, these quiz methods and thinking, okay, it's not just about passing an exam for an architect license. I need to think about it like I'm studying for an exam that is a standardized test. And once I made that mind shift, it really helped me to see, hey, okay, standardized testing, they're actually giving you the content that they're going to pull from, work on those questions, and then do question repetition, so much so that I was doing, you know, between 80 and 200 questions a day leading up to my exam, of just any practice question that I could find online, any ones that I could create on my own, because you need to get, I had really bad test anxiety. The more you numb yourself to the approach of taking an exam, the better off you'll be when you get to that point, right? The anxiety itself will subside a little bit because you've seen things like this. The pressure is taken off. And it almost was a point to where I was like, okay, I can stop focusing on how nervous I feel and start focusing on just the content and what I remember and what I've seen applied in practice.
Yeah. And those other practice questions people find, it's a way to think differently about the questions. So even though you learn while making your own, it was always those double negative questions that were always those tricky ones. And then it's just like, okay, I really have to read like every word, look for not, like, and it was because of practice exams I took from other resource materials. So I'm like, oh, okay, I got to keep an eye on that, so I don't end up missing 10 questions just because I missed a double negative in a sentence.
Right, right. And create your own study guide. Like, build it off of what you're learning, have it in real time, add notes to it, add your practice questions to it. It'll be really beneficial to you. But remember, maybe don't share it if you put what you saw on the exams. Just keep it just for you.
And I want to shift back over to your K through 12 experience.
Yes.
Because I know you found K through 12 as your passion side of the profession. Do you have any advice for others looking to find their specialty passion, whether, you know, it's K through 12, hospitals, higher ed, residential?
Yeah.
Are there any tips you have?
I really would love to say, oh, I picked my first internship firm because they did K 12. I had no idea. It was just my first internship, and I was glad I landed there. Right. And for me, it was more seeing the value in the position that I was in at the moment, right? So as an intern working on schools, it was really easy in my head to create a narrative that said, hey, my mom is a teacher. So, you know, I know what it's like for her to pour herself into a space every single day for the benefit of kids. I can motivate myself day in and day out to become an expert in this, you know, to not think about square footage, but think about the kid who needs a quiet corner to decompress and the teacher who needs natural light to stay energized because she's been there since 6 a.m. and she's not going to leave until 6 o'clock at night. Being able to humanize the aspect in your practice day to day has been what keeps me motivated. I would encourage anyone who's looking to develop a specialty, maybe do better than I did and look at what does that practice actually specify? Like, what do they work in, right? And know, hey, okay, so they do education. Okay, well, before I apply, let me develop that narrative around educational architecture and let it be something that helps my application stand out, right? Because you have an idea around it. You know, the more I got the opportunity to do schools, I really saw that there are these, you know, civic infrastructure that not only, you know, the parent, the teacher, the student, and the guardian get to experience, but an entire community does. You know, the person who's using it as a mental health facility, the family who comes and picks up food from the food pantry or uses, you know, the after hours laundry facilities. It's incredible. It's a community building. And, you know, getting to see that in schools, it's why I practice it. It's why I do it. If you are, again, looking for that specialty, find the firm that you've walked into. And maybe it's a firm that you're in now and they do residential and you're asking yourself, well, I don't really know that I'm passionate about residential. You get to work on a place that someone is going to celebrate, that they're going to grieve, that they're going to hear their best news and their worst news at. Find that as a motivation to want to learn more about it. And remember, it doesn't just have to be sector driven. It can be, Caitlin, like you're mentioning, it can be practice driven. So let's say you really love how buildings go together and how to not make a building leak. Build a technical expertise. Find those other like-minded individuals who also are fanatics about code and envelope and be in the rooms with them to learn how they speak, to learn how they talk about practice, and start to, you know, put those in your memory bank and use them out as you continue to go. Same goes with if you want to be a design expert in business development, project management, be in those rooms and then unintentionally or very intentionally build a specialty around what it is you naturally gravitate to.
Yeah. And I think that's important that it's not just picking one thing, and especially if they're giving you a list of things in college, don't listen to it because there's so many different paths. Because I found I have a very neon specialty.
Yeah.
So my specialty, I say, is education, but it is not a K-12 higher education side of education. I like educating my clients or other architects and mentoring. That's the fire, which is why I can have two businesses that are doing very different things, but my common thread is educating, teaching, and mentoring. And it wasn't until I found that different approach that that light bulb went off for me. Because for so long, I was struggling with, okay, I like higher education. I like healthcare. I like residential. And it's, why do I like all these different things? I like problem solving, but everybody told me to find a specialty. And it's because my specialty was different than somebody would expect. And that's okay.
And that's absolutely okay. Especially, you know, Caitlin, you're kind of at this, you know, intersection of, you know, entrepreneurship, architecture, and then this creator economy as well, that is completely, you know, a new scene that we would have not considered 5 years ago. But being able to develop educational content in this way and connect with people like we are right now through podcasts, through online opportunities, mm-hmm. is an entirely new, you know, career path that, you know, Gen Alpha's thinking of, because the top career path for them is a YouTuber. And like, dude, same. That sounds so fun. Like, if you were to look at it in that way, you know, how much more can you reach through that element? And it's what you're doing now. And I love to see it.
Yeah. And that's a great segue into my next question, because I know, you know, you're coming up on, you know, 10 years into the profession. And I know when I hit 10 years, it was like, holy crap, I'm 10 years in. Yes. Like, I don't believe I'm 10 years in. And you started your Rooted Reflections
yes.
series on LinkedIn. So what inspired you to write and start that? I know you were writing years before that for a bunch of other publications.
Yeah, I think I'm on, not including Rooted Reflections, on publication like 35. Like, I love writing. I love the word. Getting to share other people's stories online is where I've really found my niche in editorial content. primarily looking at people who are inspiring and bringing them forward into, you know, an amplified space. That's one of my goals, is to amplify the voice of architects. That's one of my major drivers, helping people see what it is that we do day to day beyond just here's your documentation set and here's a stamp. Like you said, it's a very, very small part of the profession. But when you get to show it's how it blossoms, its fruit is so beneficial, mm-hmm. right? And really establishing what an architect is and what an architect does. So Rooted Reflections is my monthly newsletter, semi-monthly newsletter. I'm trying to work on that. that came from, you know, wanting to be honest about the parts of professional journey that don't always show up in a portfolio that, you know, I can't describe in there alone. That, you know, I hope what people get out of it is they understand leadership is personal, growth is personal, and the architecture profession especially doesn't have enough of the honest public conversations when it comes to value, when it comes to growth, when it comes to mentorship. And, you know, if you're interested in learning more about it or being a part of it, and it's kind of to the audience, let me know. These are things that I like to talk about. Of course, Rooted Reflections is a very different piece than, you know, Instagram or YouTube, the other side of things. But it's really inspiring. You know, a lot of the people who have reached out have nothing to do with architecture. They're educators and in K through 12 spaces, or facilities managers who said, hey, I really resonated with this mentorship piece. Can you talk more about it? And that's what it's all about. You know, you're showing that we have mm-hmm. this diversified thought when it comes to how practice can be and should be. And that translates beyond just architecture. And I think that's what's been the most exciting piece that I had not originally considered is, oh, how will this affect someone who's not an architect? Well, that's not always our biggest audience, right? There's only 100,000 practicing architects in the country, right? 115, I think, is the NCARB certificates. So the more you look at things like that, you realize, hey, that audience is small, but the students who are coming up are not. Like the 100,000 mm-hmm. students in NAB accredited degrees right now, that is not a small population. Or the 40,000 architects who are currently getting their AXP and ARE, that's not a small pool. And when you see that, you know, there's some things that resonate that go beyond just our drawing set. That's really what Rooted Reflections was intended to do.
Yeah. And it's thought leadership outside of, hey, this is the project I did.
Right.
And this is how we achieved it. Because so many architecture firms just focus on the design side of thought leadership.
Mm-hmm.
But there's so much business development and relationship building on thought leadership.
Yeah.
And I think that's what I really like on Rooted Reflections is it's talking about that other side of architecture. And I love talking about that side of architecture. So it's always like, oh, yay, Gabby wrote another one. I can go take a look and see what's in there.
Oh, thanks. I think it's a lot to do. You know, you talk about the thought leadership when it comes to design. For me, I was always very not hesitant to showcase everything, but I work in schools in Texas and in Colorado that are two of the largest safety and security you know, conversation starters in the country. So my core message is, yes, we will talk about certain components of the building, but those are left to my clients. Like, they get to hold that dear and mm-hmm. precious. Yes, there will be narratives around, you know, certain elements and things, but I try to keep it as guarded as possible, because in the same way, you're like, I don't know that they want to see their entire thing blasted online, right? So that's part of it too, is like, hey, yes, I can talk about the design expertise, but that might not be as much in Rooted Reflections more than anything else, because that's mm-hmm. a guarded part of practice. And that's something that, you know, if you decide to put yourself out into the media space, you put your boundaries around, like, what are things that you personally want guarded and what are things that you're willing to express out to the larger community? And that's just part of it.
Yeah, because there's different types of social media, different
Definitely.
Types of avenues. Like me, I'm primarily on LinkedIn and Instagram, and they're completely different strategies.
Okay.
And some things can overlap, but certain things do a lot better on certain platforms over others. So That's I always find it fascinating to see the stats on what works or doesn't work. But I know the content creation side, you mentioned mm-hmm. it at the beginning, on that Architect Big Sis.
Yeah.
So where did you come up with that name and starting that messaging?
Yeah. So I go by Sis in my household. Like, my parents, my brother, they're always, that's just like Sis or Sissy, right? So like, that always stuck with me. And like, I had a t-shirt when I was a kid. It was like, I'm the big sis, you know, because you just had your younger brother, that kind of stuff. So Big Sis is something that was like big for me. I did a sorority and things. So that language had always kind of stayed with me. And I knew I was very much in a mentorship space. So I had done a few videos where I started to build into, well, you know, what what big sis advice could I offer to the internet? And when I started, it was like, okay, lessons, 30 lessons at 30 and like trying to play things. And then you realize, hey, I have this whole knowledge set that I'm an expert in. Why don't I share conversations on that? And it took a while to like build up and things, but then that's where like the architect and big sis tone started to come forward. And the core message is, you know, this profession is for you even when it doesn't feel like it. Because I didn't have that voice when I was coming up. Didn't have someone who looked or sounded like me, but or had struggled like me, had the same background. And what the goal of it is really to pull a curtain back on what the career actually looks like. So I heard time and time again from mentees, you know, what does compensation look like? Licensure, workplace advocacy, career navigation, the things that are not going to be taught in studio and then also not always talked about in the corporate environment either. So the big sis framing is really intentional. It's not meant to be a lecture, but a conversation. And it's someone who's like just a few steps ahead of saying, here's what I wish I knew. I very much try to stay, hey, I am not where I want to be yet. I'm not completely done, you know, with where I want to be, but I've learned a lot in the path. And let me show you and share with you the honest truths.
Yeah. And I think that's important for all of architecture because every person in architecture makes mistakes. Yeah. Every person in architecture makes pivots or moves or on a project that wasn't well suited for them. I always tell the young professionals, if there's a pet peeve that a principal has on a project, that's probably because they messed it up early in their career and they just don't want that to happen again.
I've seen it.
So as much as, you know, these little things can be just nuances and you can get frustrated. It's, you know, think back to the history and what they've learned. And okay, that may have been a $40,000 mistake that they learned the hard way early in their career. And they're just trying to make sure that you don't make it.
Yes.
But
actually, you bring up a really good
point.
But
those conversations don't always happen.
They don't. They only happen if you have time and maybe you're at lunch together. And they're like, let me tell you why I'm so frustrated. And I've had like at least two principals in my career who I know who have worked that way. And you know what? Now I like should give them credit for inspiration on that. Because that's exactly kind of like the thought process of, hey, let's have a coffee. Let me just tell you where I messed up so you don't do the same thing. I think that's really great. And not everyone gets that same experience, especially like if you're not in the metro and you're in a rural area and you're looking for a certain kind of experience. Well, you know, this may not fully resonate. My corporate experience might not resonate with your four-person experience, but there's some stuff that maybe can help you get your foot in the door or get to that next role or whatever your next goal is, right?
Yeah, it's just be able to know that the conversation exists, and especially when you first start your career,
yes,
you don't realize how many different things are happening at other firms until you've kind of experienced other firms.
Yeah.
That then it's, oh, that's happening over here too, and it's not just me or not just our firm. There's so many different synergies across firms, yeah. Even though every firm is different. Every firm is as unique as you and I.
Exactly. And like that should be my shout out too, to the AIA Young Architects Forum, because I was a part of that national group in 23 and 24, which really was a launch point for this as well. It's where I started writing the most because I was a communications director and editor in chief of that magazine. And that's exactly the way you describe it, Caitlin, the room of saying, hey, what is this firm doing? What's this firm doing? And it was like the first time I had seen people do it without trying to one-up each other, because you know that's how this environment mm-hmm. is. Oh, no, I actually got this promotion at this age or did this at this age. No, everyone was just genuinely trying to say, hey, here's what's working. Here's what's not. Here's how we can approach pay transparency. Here's how we can do this. And you get people who are in your same career demographic in the first 10 years after licensure, and you realize, oh, my God, yes, we are so unique, but we're going through the same things. We're going through the same frustration, mm-hmm. through the same pain points, through the same successes. So what can we learn from each other? No, I can't shout out that group enough. I love that group.
Yeah. You always have to build up that network. Yes. So then no matter where you are in life, no matter what firm you're in or what you're experiencing, you got somebody to reach out to and have a conversation. Definitely. If you can't have those big sis conversations in the office.
Yeah, for sure.
And I always like wrapping up my podcast with this final question. And it's, what advice do you have for young professionals just starting their careers?
Yes. Stop waiting to feel ready. It doesn't come, that feeling is not going to come before experience. It comes from learning as you go. Get licensed as early as you can. Document everything and find your people. That's so much more than just you know, your community, but I want you to think of your personal board of directors, those who can give you strong advocacy skills, those who are your big sisses, who are your peer mentors, and who are, you know, maybe your grandpa in architecture, someone who's been doing this or just retired, you know, that can teach you things without guard. Find that community that's willing to be transparent with you and not try to, you know, gloss what this profession looks like. And also learn to advocate for yourself. No one in the profession is going to hand you opportunities. You might have like the very, very small thing. One person who's known you your whole career and says, hey, you should be, you should get ownership of this firm. But that's few and far between. I think it's really important that we learn what we want and ask and how to ask for it specifically, especially when we're in a design and service field. It's really easy to become as small as possible and just focus on the service mission orientedness of it. But remember, this is still a career and it should be something that you are taking as much charge of as you possibly can. And finally, you know, your story is not a liability for you. The fact that you didn't come from a traditional path or that you struggled or that your journey wasn't linear, that's not something to hide away from the general public. You know, it is going to be a differentiator for you and you never know how it's going to connect to a client, to a community member, or to someone who's thinking about joining this profession.
Yeah. And I think the biggest common thread between those three is take control of your career, because you're not in school anymore where it's, you know, here's the curriculum, here's your path. It's a wide open ocean for your professional career, whether you become a design studio lead, a practice leader, or you pivot out of architecture and take those architecture skills and bring it to other industries. And that can help also enforce architecture. You could still be doing buildings on the owner side. So
yes, get into public office, be an architect in public office, right? Like you, it's so valuable what architecture education, what practice, what being a licensed architect can give the broader community. And, you know, we're always so frustrated. No one knows the value of an architect. Well, let's show them. Let's get out there and do it and show really what it is that we can offer the broader society.
Yeah, definitely. But I want to thank you, Gabby, for taking the time to speak with me today. It's always good to catch up.
Same. Thanks for having me, Caitlin.
And what is the best way to find you? Because I know you're on so many social media platforms.
Yeah, I know.
So how do people find you?
I need to tone those down a little bit. So on Instagram, it's at Gabby Bermea, two B's and a Y. And then LinkedIn is Gabriella Vermeer. Of course, that's where you can find the Reader Reflections newsletter. I'm also on TikTok and YouTube, which is new, so bear with me. But those are both Gabby Vermeer 3, because I can't get Gabby Vermeer because I should have joined it 10 years ago.
Don't worry. I couldn't even get Mentor Dino on Instagram. So
I know. It's nuts. I love it. Just need to, should have been on it 15 years ago when I started my Instagram in the first place. So.
But I'll put all those links in the show notes below so it's easy for anybody to find you on their favorite platform.
Thank you
again, Gabby.
Thanks, Caitlin.
I hope you enjoyed our discussion today. Learn some advice to take with you and see how our industry is all tied together to create the world around us. Check out the description below for any links or resources we discussed. If you liked the episode, please do me a favor and hit the subscribe button. Give me a thumbs up and leave a comment below. It really helps others be able to discover this resource and support finding that career path that best works for them. If you know someone that has inspired your own career that you'd like me to interview, let me know in the comments below, or you can reach out to me via my website or LinkedIn. I'd be happy to share their story or your own. Thank you again, and I cannot wait for the next career story I get to share with you next week.